The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. I'm Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway. The lead story of today is you. You had a great long weekend. According to the Wall Street Journal, everything and everywhere were jam with people celebrating their new independence from COVID and their face masks gone on the mall. Tens of thousands of people in Wisconsin. They covered it in Southport, North Carolina. They had reporters all over the country, and they had a terrific day of celebration, and then a nice day off for barbecues yesterday. Maybe you watched, as I did, Tomorrowland, Tomorrow War, with a Chris Pratt new movie, which is just terrific for dads. It's a good old-fashioned shoot-em-up. I'm sure that Fetching Mrs. Hewitt wouldn't like it, but you will. The sad, sad story continues in Sunnyside, Surfside, Florida, where the death toll is up to 28 this morning after demolition of an additional part of the building continued yesterday, so that searchers can seek the human remains. There's a small chance that someone could be alive in what they call a tunnel. But I think that's really remote. In any event, they're up to 24. They have to work fast. They have to suspend as lightning occurs as the tip of tropical storm Elsa approaches Surfside. There was a Wall Street Journal article yesterday on the back and forth between the city and the contractor to begin the project on the Surfside condominium, Champlain Towers. And I got to tell you, although the city would have been named in every wrongful death lawsuit, they are now going to be the focus of more than wrongful death lawsuits because of the apparently desultory response of city officials to repeated requests from the engineer to get going. And to get, having been a land use lawyer for 32 years before I retired, it's the same story with every government agency everywhere. They're not paid to be efficient. They're paid to be there. And I used to keep a rule of thumb on every permit that I filed for from the Army Corps of Engineers, the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the EPA, Cal EPA, California Department of Fish and Game. You had to send it in at least a half dozen times. First couple, it would be law. Second couple are sort of making a marker. I never get upset about it. It's just something you have to do. They don't move it to the top of the pile until you're chattering and nattering, and that is government. And it's grown sclerotic, and you can't fire anyone. I can tell you dozens of stories, no need to tell you now, the names and places of people who simply didn't do their job, couldn't be bothered, had to be coaxed into doing their job, and who were skating as they neared pension land, and who were afraid to take decisions because of responsibility, and who lacked the intellectual capacity to keep up with good deals. I mostly dealt on the federal side, some state, occasionally a local development. I'd do a master plan community somewhere, and if you can get elected officials, they're typically more responsive than permanent people. But boy, this is going to turn into quite a in-depth dive into bureaucracy. And by the way, what's true at Surfside is true of every country, state, county, and town government, which is that they are sclerotic by the nature of government because you cannot fire them. The Supreme Court term is wrapped up. Justice Breyer is not retired. I suppose it could still come, but I can't imagine he wants to quit before the abortion case and the guns cases that are on the term docket for 2021-2022, maybe race cases as well. But it was a big term for the Supreme Court. As it took a right turn. Some say gentle, some say decisive. I say it's a right turn. It takes a while for the court to get where it's going, but it's going back to originalism. And it can't go fast enough for me, but I know progress when I see it. That was real progress. Retail investors power the trading wave with record cash inflows. People are beginning to come out of their bunkers, their financial bunkers, realize the world is not ending. A lot of it is sick, as I'll come to shortly. And they're putting money into the market through their own investment counselors, through Robinhood, through other online platforms like E-Trade. They are going to be in the game. They're going to stay in the game. Hackers have knocked down hundreds of businesses over the weekend. A hacking group sent a sprawling ransomware attack in the hours before the 4th of July weekend began, and businesses across the country are deciding whether to pay or move on. The FBI is not much use in this. They are investigating, of course, but every business has to make its own choice. They want Bitcoin, by the way, Bitcoin. The Delta variant is surging across the world of COVID. Death hospitalizations are crippling, especially in the third world. West Java is the subject of the article that I'm reading right now, but it's everywhere. In fact, Israel had good news and bad news for us yesterday about the Delta variant. The Pfizer vaccine prevents it entirely in more than 60% of the cases and prevents hospitalization in 98% of the cases. So it's definitely wise to get it. But it's not as effective against the Delta variant as against A, B, and C. In the Telegraph, it reports that the coronavirus news, they're hitting 50,000 cases a day in Great Britain. But because the country has been vaxxed to a certain point where Health Minister Sajid Javid, I hope I got that right. Yeah, Sajid Javid said that the situation with COVID-19 can change and it can change quickly, but we cannot put our lives on hold forever, and that the vaccines had broken the link between the virus and death and hospitalization. So they're going back to normal in Great Britain, the new normal, on July 19th. More than 1,000 Afghan soldiers fled into Tajikistan as the Taliban extended their control across parts of the country, Tajik officials say. That's the third mass desertion in that part of the country. 140 students are missing and presumed kidnapped after gunmen storm a school in northwest Nigeria. A great story, which I tweeted out yesterday, You Really Need to Quit Twitter, by Caitlin Flanagan. The best article on Twitter to date. Not that it's terrible for you, it's what does it do? What does it do for you? And the answer is very little, except suck time. Good, good thing to study up on. When we come back in the third segment today, I'm going to be covering for you PCC or PC3. That's politically correct curriculum or politically correct curriculum. That covers politically correct content as well. It can be in schools, it can be in museums, it can be in churches. Politically correct curriculum or content is that which is driven by politics, not by knowledge, facts, and objective reality. And in Loudoun County and at the Alamo this weekend, there were stories in the Washington Post today about how politically correct content or curriculum, PCCC or PC3, has come to dominate discussions in both Texas and Virginia. And unfortunately, it's not good stuff. Anthony Fauci on with Chuck Todd yesterday, cut number 7.
Can a fully vaccinated person be an asymptomatic spreader of the virus and, more importantly, this variant?
The answer is you'd have to say yes. I mean, if you're looking at studies that are being done, we will get the answer to that, because we are looking at situations where you have vaccinated people who have breakthrough infections. Namely, they're infected despite the fact that they've been vaccinated. Most of these people will be without symptoms. If you look at the level of virus in their nasopharynx, it appears to be significantly less than individuals who are unvaccinated, who get infected, and who have asymptomatic infection. So when you look at the level of virus to be lower, that would mean you could make a reasonable assumption that those individuals would be less likely to transmit the infection to someone else.
Yeah.
Vaccinated person, breakthrough infection, unlikely. But it's not going to be zero, because whenever you have biological phenomena, there's always a range. But for the most part, it would be less likely.
Okay, so the bottom line is it's possible, not likely, that people who have been vaccinated can spread. That doesn't change the way that people who have been vaccinated live. It might change the way that people who are not vaccinated live, in that their interactions with vaccinated people are not as safe as they had thought. Let me also play for you Ron DeSantis in Florida at a press conference talking about the Surfside survivors and those in the area, cut number 2.
You're going to have a lot of mental health impacts from people who were able to get out. Obviously, the families who lost somebody, that's going to be the most devastating. But I've spoken with a number of the folks who've been able, who were able to get out. this is a really harrowing experience. And you literally have people that, had their unit been 20 feet another direction, they would have been in rubble. And so they're and their neighbor has never been heard from again. And so this is something that's very traumatic. So the mental health aspects are going to be very, very important. And this is something that is going to be require long-term support. But I can tell you the support is there. Getting through some of the bureaucracy to channel that sometimes in situations like this, unfortunately, can be something that we have to do.
But yeah, it takes a while, but he's down there doing it. Good on Governor DeSantis. I got a lot more to cover with you. Don't go anywhere, America. It's the Hugh Hewitt Show on Tuesday, July the 6th, 2021. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Thank you so much for listening to Hugh Hewitt Show. I'm joined now by David Drucker, the Washington Examiner. Good morning, Drucker. How are you?
And great, Hugh. How are you?
Good. Thank you for the review copy of your book, which I will read in blurb. I'm wondering, when is it going to drop?
We're still working all of that out. And I don't want to get ahead of whatever it is my agent's going to tell me, you know, how I'm supposed to talk about this and what I'm going to do. But it's coming in the next few months, 3, 4 months. I don't know. It's coming. Which, you know how this works better than me.
I do. And I'm not going to tweet anything that's in it.
Which I trust. Well, I knew you wouldn't, so I didn't worry about that.
Yeah, but, you know, actually, people screw up. I've seen people screw up review copies more times than I can number. And you were very kind. You didn't even put in there, Hugh, I'm not going to send you an NDA, but please don't tweet. You just assumed I knew the rules, but it's very, very funny. Hey, Drucker, I want to talk to you about two stories I just did. The Alamo story, which is in the Washington Post today. Texas Republicans cancel an event called the Truth About the Alamo or something like that. And then in Loudoun County, they've got 10,000 demonstrators out there, you know, different, that's an exaggeration, different things going on in Loudoun County. I think politically correct curriculum and content is going to be a big deal in 2022. And it's not all race and it's not all gender and it's just anything that is done for reasons other than pedagogy that, you know, they're just everywhere. It's breaking out in museums and schools. Is it going to carry over a year from now?
Well, that's hard to tell. Look, my rule of thumb with topics is that they could be a big deal, but we don't know for sure because we don't know the state of the world around the time that people start really paying attention to candidates and focusing on an upcoming election. The world moves so fast. There is so much happening. And so sometimes what we are sure is going to matter 18 months from now or a year from now, turns out it doesn't, not because it doesn't matter, but because other things have happened that are filling up the oxygen politically and culturally. So these are the things that could matter. And we have seen signs of parents concerned about the kinds of education that their children are getting, especially over the last year. But will this be the dominant story or a dominant story or part of the cornucopia of stories that influences votes? I never make those decisions until we get closer.
Assume for a moment that it's just the Virginia governor's election that we're looking at and not the whole cycle. And you've got Glenn Youngkin against Terry McAuliffe. Will this last until November? Because that is into the governor's cycle.
Well, correct. So we're close enough to a governor's race in Virginia where we can try and gauge a little bit more how much this matters. I'm really interested to see how potent this is in suburban Northern Virginia, suburban Richmond, and down in Norfolk, Virginia Beach and all of that. It'll be interesting to see. One, we know that it's piqued the interest of parents. What is the state of the economy going to be in the next few months? But this is the kind of thing that could matter. Look, we know just from the perspective of following politics for, you know, more than 5 minutes, that voters get very concerned about their safety. They get very concerned about their children's education. They get very concerned about the cost of healthcare. These are the things that tend to dominate in addition to what is always important, which is the state of their pocketbook.
So let me also ask you, though, David, I think parents are also, like other voters, simply exhausted by political conflict. And they're saying, everybody, please shut up.
and they're turning off cable TV because it's never informative. It's always an argument. And I think a lot of the PCC debate and critical race theory or whatever you want to call it, PC3, PCCC, whatever you want to call it, I think it's all driven by a tiny fraction of people. And the vast majority of Americans, left, right and center, just want people to shut up in the off here. And I think that's going to help Glenn Youngkin in Virginia.
Well, it could. It could. We'll see. I agree with you on the larger topic. I do think people are exhausted. All right. I think that worked against the former president in November. I think it could work against people on the work against Democrats in some off year elections if voters start to feel like they're the ones pushing the exhaustion, the elements that are causing the exhaustion. But I think it's too, for that, it's too soon to tell. And particularly because Virginia is now a decidedly sort of light blue state. I mean, there are still signs of life for Republicans, but it has transitioned. And sometimes in our tribal politics, it's hard to get over those sorts of cultural changes.
Yeah, Youngkin is very much a fusion candidate from the center to the right. He is not a divisive candidate, and Ken Cuccinelli, I know, but he ran from the right. Glenn Youngkin's running from the center out, and he's brought a lot of people under his tent already. I'm very optimistic about his chances because I think Terry McAuliffe, last word to you, I think he's worn his welcome out.
Well, look, it's always dangerous when you try and revive and sort of go back to the future, so to speak. So, look, Youngkin has a shot as a Democrat in the White House. Let's see if he can overcome Virginia's blue tilt.
All right, David, good to talk to you as always. David M. Drucker on Twitter. I'll be right back. Hour two of the Tuesday Hugh Hewitt Show ahead. Morning, Glory America. Bonjour. Hi, Canada. Hugh Hewitt inside the Beltway on July 6th. Joined by Byron York of the Washington Examiner, also of Fox. Good morning, Byron. Hope you had a great 4th of July.
Good morning, Hugh. I did indeed. Thank you.
It was back to normal, and boy, did I like normal. Byron, I was talking last hour with David Drucker about two stories in the Post, and they may be in the Examiner as well, for all I know. The first is about a program canceled at the Bullock Texas State History Museum in Austin that was going to rip on traditional Alamo mythology, and then the Loudoun County culture wars. Now, because there are transgendered issues and because there are critical race theory issues and there are a whole bunch of other issues, I've just lumped it under politically correct curriculum and content, or PC3. And I want to ask you, is it going to be an issue through the entirety of 2022?
Well, first of all, David was very cautious, which is understandable because who knows exactly what's going to happen. But I think that the answer is yes. I mean, because these are just continuations, perhaps on steroids, of the issues of political correctness that have been a big deal for a long time, of books being banned from schools, of curricula being changed. You know, but the bigger thing about 2022 that kind of strikes me is, I wrote a story maybe a couple of weeks ago, and then Politico followed up with a different twist on it, which was about the Democrats' disinclination to investigate the origins of COVID. They really don't want to do it, and I compared it to their enthusiasm for investigating the Trump-Russia matter, which they never found the collusion, but they wanted a federal investigation. There were investigations in the House. There were investigations in the Senate. They couldn't get enough investigation. And now Republicans are pushing for an investigation into the origins of COVID, which has, after all, killed 621,000 Americans. And they're not very interested. And the reason in this political report was that they're worried that the lab leak theory, which is more and more plausible, might kind of squeeze out their greater desire to use the investigation to get Trump, to focus on the Trump administration's specific handling of certain aspects of the COVID matter. This is also something very similar you're seeing in the fight over a January 6th Capitol riot commission, because obviously there's a huge justice investigation of what the rioters themselves did, more than 500 people charged, enormous detail coming out about some of their actions. There are investigations of the lack of preparedness, which was astonishing, really, of Capitol Police and other security forces. The big fight over it is Democrats want to make Trump the center, what he did on that day and before the center of their investigation. So I think all of this points to the idea that they're hoping they can make Trump the issue in 2022. And can they? Maybe they can. I don't know.
Well, but that's what I call politically correct content. That is programming decisions, whether on museum or networks and newspapers or in classrooms, being driven by agendas, which are typically power driven in the case of politics. To me, the most interesting story right now, Byron, is actually an anti-government story. When people dive into Surfside and the collapse and the tragedy that is still unfolding before our eyes, they're going to find a local government indifferent and simply inattentive to the ordinary course of business. I began to read the Journal story on this yesterday, and it's every single permitting decision I ever had was left a trail of emails like that, begging, pleading, cajoling, threatening established government figures to do their jobs. And I don't think that the elite media is going to want to dive too deeply into this, because they're going to find failures of government at every turn. They're also going to find the tyranny of homeowners associations at every turn. In other words, that's not politically correct content. That is not the kind of curriculum they're going to teach in schools, which is an anti-government, a suspicion of government, and a tradition of liberty. They're going to want to go back to transgendered students. And I honestly, God bless anyone who's struggling with their gender identity. It's not my problem, and it's not mine to comment on, but it's also 0.006% of the population or something like that in high school. And it shouldn't be driving our national conversation in any way, shape, or form. We ought to be looking at Surfside and every other government issue in America. What say you, Byron York?
Well, actually, I have to agree with that. And the Surfside question is one of simple good government. And now I do think that just there was a complete failure all around from what I've read. Everybody could see the problems with the building, but nobody could conceive that the building would just fall down. I mean, it was just a failure of their imagination. And now you're not going to have that kind of failure of the imagination in the future. But you're absolutely right about homeowners associations and about this permitting inspection process. That is the kind of good government story that I can certainly understand the press emphasizing. It's what I want to read. I mean, I'm interested in finding out about this. But it doesn't carry a political message. It's vastly more important in terms of the people affected than issues of pronouns. So it's something.
Let's focus on that, Byron. City engineering and government responsiveness is far more important to the vast majority of the millions listening right now than transgendered issues. There are a few people who are concerned about transgendered issues. I don't deny that. But everybody has a stake. And my goodness, I can do show after show on homeowners association and local government in local governments. But if they hear Loudoun County or they hear Surfside, they sort of turn it off except for Surfside's drama. They don't want that. That's a local news thing. The transgender thing is an ideological content and critical race theory, subset of critical legal theory, that's of, by, for the left, period.
Absolutely defined by the left. But the collapse of the building in Surfside made it an issue that transcends all of that stuff. It made it an important issue for everybody. Everybody who lives in a building, either a single family home or an apartment building, condo, whatever. So, I mean, this is just so vastly more important. Also, obviously, as I was just speaking, the importance of COVID is because so many people have died. Well, in this case, more than 100 people died in this case. This is absolutely self-evidently more important than some of these ideological spats.
100%. And Byron, if we compare and contrast, when hurricanes come through, governments get off the hook because it's a natural force. When earthquakes strike in California and buildings fall down, governments get off because they say, oh, we have to update the codes and no one can see this coming. When a building collapses of its own weight due to structural flaws, there is human error there. Whether it is originally. Now, the problem is also with our legal system, because everybody has papered the record of every building because of plaintiff's lawyers. And this is a very complicated matter I was discussing with my old boss in the White House over the weekend. There is no getting around the fact that plaintiff's lawyers have driven people to pad their files and go slow and issue. Everybody issues an alarmist report to a certain degree so that they can protect themselves against this. And the real alarms then don't get heard, Byron.
Well, in this case, the alarmist report, here again, stopped short of recognizing that the building could actually collapse. I mean, this is the enormous failure of the people who were inspecting and assessing that. But, you know, you mentioned hurricanes, earthquakes, natural disasters. These are events that the news media can just jump on without, at least in the past, some of their ideological blinders, without some of their political content, at least in the beginning, because these are stories. What happened? How many people are hurt?
Okay, Byron, here's a test. You watch and I will watch for how many stories follow up on the building's engineer's request for a curb cut to add 5 to 7 spaces so that work could begin. And that was a May 21 request. That is a very minor request, and it languished. I mean, it's their private property. They ought to have been allowed to do a curb cut to put in 5 parking spaces so they could restore their building. And the city screwed around. Do you think we'll see a lot? Because it's so boring and so small, but it became a matter of tendentiousness because cities just don't respond to stuff.
Well, it's so boring and so small, but also parking is a huge issue. I mean, it really is. And obviously, in light of what happened, it was a trivial thing. It seems so incredibly small. But, I mean, there are intense fights about parking in every crowded area in America. And
Amen.
Buildings that have garages, who gets a space, who doesn't get a space, how much area is devoted for it. I mean, these are issues that people get really passionate about in a hyper-localized way in their building.
And we should take the lens out. And we'll see if the media does. And if they don't begin to recognize that government has the same sclerosis everywhere, it's especially pronounced at the local level. Byron York on Twitter and in the Washington Examiner on Fox. Thank you, Byron. Talk to you next week. Stay tuned, America. Back, America, to Hewitt, July 6th show. That music cues Admiral James Stavridis, retired United States Navy, former Allied Supreme Commander of NATO, former head of Southern Command, currently chairman of the Rockefeller Foundation, and a brand new job at the Carlyle Group. I can't remember the exact title, Admiral. What is it?
Vice Chairman, Global Affairs. So I conduct, as you would expect, geopolitical advice for the firm across our very large global footprint. It's a real honor.
Well, congratulations on that, Admiral. I have a question for you. I can go anywhere with you. I can go to academia because your time is Dean at Fletcher School. I can go business. I can go anywhere. I want to talk to you about change of command today because the biggest story on Monday was Amazon founder Jeff Bezos stepped down as CEO on Monday, handing over the reins as the company navigates the challenge of a world fighting to emerge from the coronavirus pandemic. Andy Jassy, who ran Amazon's cloud computing business, replaces Bezos. Now, we all knew this was coming. It's sort of like a change of command. I am curious. You've been on both sides of changes of command, Admiral, many, many times, giving the reins to a newcomer, taking the reins from someone who's leaving the ship or a business or a school or now an endowment. What are the key issues when someone does that?
The key issues are hoping that there'll be continuity for the good ideas that the outgoing commander has put in place. But you probably know this, given your own connections to the military. There's an old saying that no good idea survives a change of command ceremony. And
I haven't
that's
heard
human
that.
Nature. Yeah, that's human nature. The new boss wants to make his or her mark coming in. And that's fine up to a point. What you worry about, particularly in the military, which, as you know, does changes of command every 2 to 3 years, way too often, in my view. Bezos has been at the helm of Amazon for a couple of decades. A better model is the business world here, where you can't imagine a CEO taking charge for less than 5 years. Typical is 10 years. Same thing at a university, by the way. 5 years, very short tenure. 10 years feels about right for a president or a dean. Military, we're churning all the time. and that holds us back. So that's kind of point two, is be careful of the short-term whipsaw effect it can have on the people in the organization. And I think number three, as the incoming commander, is kind of the mirror image of those two points. You want to be very respectful of the good ideas that your predecessor put in place. Naturally, there are going to be some things you want to change. But bottom line, you try and find the balance between keeping what the organization's been doing and what you want it to do going forward. It's a delicate balance.
Now, Admiral, I have heard about the military that there's a tendency to go good cop, bad cop at some level. I can't remember what the level is in the Marine Corps. It might be brigade, and in squadrons in the Air Force and the Navy, and in ships, good cop, bad cop. That, yeah, by the way, is not in academia. Academia usually goes great dean, bad dean. It's just almost inevitable. If you have a great dean, you're going to have a bad dean. If you have a bad dean, you're going to get a great dean. I'm not sure about CEOs of business. It seems to me too large of a data set to absorb. But what ought people to be looking for in any situation? Shouldn't they try for good cop all the time?
Oh, absolutely. And, another angle to what you're describing is, in many military organizations, there is another good cop, bad cop that's different than the succession of the commander. It is the commander and the deputy commander. So on a ship, would say the CO and an XO, the XO standing for executive officer, second in command. You see often in military organizations a benevolent leader and a kind of take charge, push hard executive officer right below him or her. So that's another model. And frankly, that ain't all bad. In organizations, it can be very important that you have someone who can deliver the bad news, who can be the face of disagreement, who can push the organization very hard while the leader kind of stays on top and stays at the strategic level. Another way to think of it is, who's on the inside making the sausage every minute and who's looking up with the larger strategic view out there. But in terms of succession, CO to CO to CO in the military context, CEO to CEO in the business context, absolutely, you want to go good to good to good. I'll conclude on this by saying, here's another point of this to bear in mind. Really good CEOs, really good COs in the military context, they're always looking for top talent, and they're not afraid to surround themselves with the very best. A way to put that Don Rumsfeld, may rest in peace, used to say, A's hire A's, B's hire C's, because the B's don't want the competition in the team around them. They want to look like the person at the very top. So for good COs and good CEOs, what you want to look for is that tendency to hire the very best, surround themselves with talent. A's hire A's, you want an A.
Now, Admiral, by the way, I appreciated your tweet and your column about Secretary Rumsfeld. I've posted over at my podcast, the interview with Hugh Hewitt, two long-form interviews I did with him on the publication of his memoir and the publication of Rumsfeld's Rules, and I recommend that to anyone who knew and loved Donald Rumsfeld. I want to now switch, and I don't mean to cast blame. This isn't really about casting blame. It's about looking at Surfside and the city government there. And for all I know, you might know everyone in the city government of Surfside. It's pretty far south of where you live. And whether or not they ought to immediately resign and be replaced, if not by interims. Because when the Navy has a catastrophic incident, people are replaced pretty quickly so that investigations into it, I believe, can be forthcoming and candid. If you were the Surfside City Council, they ought to stay out their terms because they're democratically elected. But they have a city manager and they have building inspectors. Would you sweep everyone, ask for resignations, and not vindictively, but in order to get to the bottom of what happened there?
Here I would apply the Navy principle, which is to be pretty direct, pretty quick, and pretty sweeping in terms of consequence for leaders in the chain of command. And I'll give you a classic example of this, Hugh, from several years ago. You'll recall when, tragically, two of our Navy destroyers, brand new ships, Arleigh Burke destroyers, top of the line, both within months of each other, had collisions in the Pacific, which resulted in the deaths of 17 sailors. What the Navy did in that instance, we fired the 4-star, we fired the 3-star, we fired the 2-star, we fired the 1-star, we got rid of the Commodore, the officer in charge of the group of destroyers. We fired both of the commanding officers, the executive officers, and the command master chiefs. Now, fire may be maybe extreme. In some cases, they were forced to retire early. In some cases, they were shuttled off to non-important assignments. But we cleaned house. And we felt we had to because of the loss of life, because of the sweeping ramifications of those kind of collisions. And I'm not saying apply the Navy rule to Surfside, but that principle of swift accountability, I think, is something that is salutary. And you also finish with this. You also need to find the balance between these are people, the leadership you mentioned, they're still in the middle of the fight. So I don't think this is the moment to reach in and pull them out. But I think pretty quickly it will become the moment to say, yes, you have not only responsibility, but accountability for what has occurred here. And I would look for resignations and or dismissals.
Now, the last question, Admiral, with regard to that, goes to the general problem of government, which is sclerosis. And I have spent 30 plus years. I'm a retired lawyer now. And I spent 30 of those years arguing with the government to please process permits that were supposed to be routine and to make decisions that ought not to have been difficult and to take into account principles which are enduring, like private property rights, often to the great frustration of my clients and me. It seems to me that government outside of the military is plagued by sclerosis. And a lot of that has to do with the overemphasis of civil service protections that came after the patronage system. Do we need to rebalance in order to keep the blood moving?
I think that's a good analogy. And perhaps what we need here is a bit of a transfusion to shift your metaphor slightly. Maybe we need a messenger RNA vaccine that can get into these systems and change the fundamentals of what's inside them, thus creating faster flow, new ideas. And you hit the right word. It's balance. It's not an on and off switch, right? It's a rheostat. You've got to kind of crack that valve open, put those new ideas in. And back to where we started this conversation, that's what leaders do. Steven Jobs said, the difference in the end between followers and leaders is the courage to innovate. And that's the new vaccine, if you will. That's the new idea. You've got to continually inject new fuel into the machine.
You know, Admiral, I know that you began by saying the military may do this too quickly, but I think civilian side government does it way too slowly, especially at the state and local level. They've got to blow out leadership more often. And I don't mean because they're bad. It's just because they're blind often to their habits. And if someone's in a job for 3 years in civilian government as a city manager, as a head of planning, they're just, or as a permit issuer in any capacity, they're just going to become more invested in their own careers and their own people than they are in the public interest. That's my deep felt belief after 30 years of tangling with them.
I have no disagreement with that. The key is finding the balance. What's the right point? Where in the organization? How do you get the new in, but still have the continuity and maintain the balance? But when you see big failures from ships colliding to condos collapsing, you know it's time to accelerate the process of change in these organizations.
Well said, Admiral. I think maybe a magic rule is never longer than 7 years in any job, just never longer than seven, unless you own it like Jeff Bezos did. Admiral, great to talk to you as always. Follow him on Twitter at Stav. Read his Bloomberg column. You'll be smarter for that, just as you are for listening to him every week. Time for me to remind you, Relief Factor. I keep it close. I take it every day. Why? Because it works every day. It's something you need if you're going to stay out there. I got a very nice compliment over the weekend. Someone noticed I'd been shedding pounds. They said, what else are you going to do during the shutdown? I just upped the mileage. Why did I up the mileage? Because what else are you going to do during a shutdown? You can only watch so many Marvel movies, right? You can only read so many books. And I do both of those things a lot. And if you get a Tomorrow War out there, I'll go watch Tomorrow War. Sonny Bunch and I agree it's a terrific movie. It's on Amazon Prime. I can't believe they didn't release it in theaters, except as one of the Hewitt children pointed out to me, that would defeat the purpose of Amazon Prime, which is to grab subscribers when they hear about things like Tomorrow War. Well, you can only do so much of everything. And the one thing you can't really do too much of is walk or trundle. Now, yesterday I trundled. Now, remember the Hewitt system. If you're running faster than 10 minutes a mile, you're running. If you're moving between 10 and 15 minutes a mile, on average, you're trundling. If you're over 15 minutes a mile, you're walking. And scooters don't count, Dwayne, sorry. So if no matter what you're doing, it's good for you. No matter what you're doing, you're active, as Tim Cook, CEO of Apple, aforementioned successor to Steve Jobs, is Admiral Stavridis was talking about Steve Jobs. If you are moving at least 3 miles a day is what you should be your goal, then you're feeling better. And if you are doing that, you might get some minor aches and pains. That's where ReliefFactor.com enters in. $19.95. Give it a try. Stop living off a leave. Stop taking Advil. Try the natural way. ReliefFactor.com. Coming back with Kornacki. What does the polling say about politically correct content and curriculum? We'll find out from Kornacki next on The Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. I'm Hugh Hewitt on July the 6th. I'm joined by Steve Kornacki of NBC News, the man in the khaki, Steve Kornacki. Good morning, Steve. How are you? I hope you had a great 4th.
Good morning, Hugh. I had a great 4th. I hope you did as well.
Indeed, except the Indians have lost 8 in a row, so that's kind of tough. But that's other than off topic. There are two stories this morning, Steve, in the Washington Post. I'm curious if you've seen anything come up in your polling. One is about Loudoun County school district politics. Another is about a Texas museum canceling a talk about the Alamo, which is contra the Alamo mythology of Texas. And I now am calling it PCCC, which is politically correct content or curriculum, whether it is race, transgendered, equity issues, whatever it is, it's all under PC3 heading. Is this resonating beyond news media searching for stories? Is it deeply embedded in the conversation, or is this a Twitter phenomenon?
You know, I'm asking myself the same question, but that's one of the reasons I think we're going to get some clarity with the Virginia race, the governor's race in Virginia in November. I know you were talking about that a bit earlier. I mean, Loudoun County, where this story is playing out that you're talking about, is one of the counties that I've been saying since, you know, the start of this campaign, is one of the counties I'd be looking at on election night at sort of as an indicator of national mood and of what's happening in sort of Northern Virginia, the suburbs of Northern Virginia. I mean, Loudoun County, fast growing outside Washington, D.C. It's the kind of place, if you went back just a little bit more than a decade ago, Republicans could win it consistently. If you went back to just 2012, when Mitt Romney was running against Barack Obama, Obama carried it, but was only by a couple of points. It was a swing county. And then you look at 2020, Biden versus Trump in Loudoun County. Biden wins the county by 25 points. So, I mean, this is one of those fast-growing metropolitan area outside Washington, D.C., that has moved dramatically towards the Democratic Party over the last decade. And I'm really, really curious to see if that number comes down, if it comes down significantly this November. And I think it'd be an indicator if the kind of local issues, that school fight you're talking about there, if that's pushing people away at all from that shift they've made to the Democratic Party in recent times.
Now, it's because I'm a Virginia resident and a Virginia voter that I followed it very closely. Glenn Youngkin, I think, won the convention, and it was ranked voting in Virginia because he jumped on one issue, and he was very, very strong on this, as one might expect the former CEO of Carlyle Group to be. He attacked the Virginia State Education Department's mandate that there not be accelerated math prior to the 11th grade. So you could be a math wizard in 4th grade, 7th grade, 9th grade, or 10th grade, and you wouldn't get an advanced math class until 11th grade. It's a, quote, equity, close quote, issue in education. I think it's a PC3 issue. And Youngkin hit it again and again and again. And I think when you get to schools and the quality of schools, Steve Kornacki, R&D don't mean anything close to ACT and SAT. And especially in Northern Virginia, where Thomas Jefferson High School is moving from a pure merit-based system like Stuyvesant High School in New York to a race-based system that will discriminate against Asian Americans almost immediately, that parents are going to be upset and their family members are going to be upset. Do you see this having traction?
Yeah, I mean, that is the opportunity, I think, that Republicans see, because what you're describing kind of demographically in Northern Virginia is something you see replicated all around the country. That, you know, suburbs, metropolitan areas, bedroom communities, parents with kids, you know, school-age kids in public schools, maybe parents who move to towns, move to counties because they like the public schools, they want to send their kids there. That's a demographic the Democrats have been doing better and better with in recent times. That trend I described in Loudoun, you can see trends like that all around the country, in places like that all around the country. And I think what you're describing there, and I think what Republicans are seeing, is the possibility that here is an issue that could speak to those voters and that could get those voters to say, you know, if the Democratic Party is connected to the kind of backlash here that the Republicans are trying to foment here a little bit, that could get those voters to rethink that shift. And that's why, again, I Loudoun's a perfect example. There's, you know, the Richmond area in Virginia. There are a bunch of places I'm going to look at on election night in November. And that's the thing I want to see, that sort of surge level of support that Biden was able to attain there in 2020, or even that Hillary Clinton was able to get in 2016. Have the numbers come down off that? And if they have, I think that's going to answer your question with an emphatic yes.
Now, it's interesting, Steve. I wouldn't say Republicans are fomenting it. I think the left is fomenting it, but they are certainly reacting to it. And who is, in fact, the prime mover of these controversies? Is it the left or is it the right? Will matter significantly in how people assess them. Now, I'm neutral because I don't know the facts of every case, but doesn't that really, don't people just want schools to be about educating students for life and not about ideology?
Well, yeah, you're right. It's about how it's perceived, you know, how the maneuvering is perceived by the voters in these places. Is it perceived as something that, you know, Democrats in power are doing, and that therefore the Republicans are sort of the opposition vehicle that you want to be with if you want to fight what the Democrats are doing? Is it perceived? You know, so yes, I agree with you. I think it's it comes down to how parents view this in their own backyard. And if they are offended by it, if they don't like it, is it something that they then say, this is the Democrats' fault? I want to hold the Democrats responsible for it. And that's the way, you know, politics work. If you want to hold one party responsible, you vote for the other.
Steve Kornacki of NBC, thank you. Follow him on Twitter at Steve Kornacki. Tom Cotton is next, America, on the Hugh Hewitt Show. I want to remind you that our sponsor is andrewandtodd.com. There with Sierra Pacific, they lend you money to refinance your house or buy a home, or help your son or daughter become investors in real estate by becoming a non-occupying co-borrower. They help senior citizens with reverse mortgage. They help veterans with no money down mortgages. They help you refinance. So if you need to get money out of your house or you need a whole new house, go to andrewandtodd.com or call them at 888-1172. Morning Glory America, bonjour, hi Canada, Hugh Hewitt on July the 6th, joined by Senator Tom Cotton of Arkansas. A belated happy 4th of July to you, Senator. I hope you had a great one with the family.
Yeah, likewise to you, Hugh, and all your listeners. Hope everyone enjoyed the weekend celebrating America's birthday and our independence. Everyone still has all their fingers, so that's a success in the Cotton household.
Excellent, excellent. Let me begin by noting that you went to Iowa a week ago, so after your appearance on this show, we were flooded with stories about, is Tom Cotton ruling out 2024? Somebody actually asked you that at the Daily Signal, and I believe you said you're not, joining Chris Christie, Mike Pompeo, Nikki Haley, Tim Scott, Rick Scott, and a host of others, and not ruling out 2024. Is that a fair summary?
Well, Hugh, it was great to be back in Iowa. I was also in South Dakota that day as well. I did a small Midwest swing to support my colleagues up for re-election, Chuck Grassley and John Thune. And that's where my focus is right now, after stopping the Biden agenda, winning back our majority in 2022. And I suspect future elections will work themselves out in time.
I love that answer. It's inconsistent with the rest. Let me get to the issue of the morning. In the Washington Post, there are two stories. Loudoun County parents upset with their school board over a number of issues, including transgenderism. And in the state of Texas, your colleagues Cruz and Cornyn will know about this, the lieutenant governor ordered canceled at the Texas State Museum a disparaging museum program on the Alamo, calling it a myth. These are both PCCs, politically correct content or curriculum cases, PC3. Is this actually a thing, or is it just a media thing, Senator?
No, Hugh, regrettably, it is a real problem in school districts across the country. Obviously, and in some very liberal jurisdictions, it's worse than it is, say, in most places here in Arkansas. Like, I mean, Loudoun County, though, has just gone around the bend. If you follow that story, I mean, they've got school board members and administrators who are surveilling parents on social media who object to their children being indoctrinated with, you know, critical race theory or radical gender theories or other Marxist theories. Look, I think most parents want their kids to learn the basic skills they need to succeed in the world. They want them to learn about our past so we can build on our great successes and we can correct some of our flaws. They don't want to see their kids indoctrinated and sometimes have that indoctrination hidden from them and have the people who are doing the indoctrinating, whether it's the administrators, the teachers, or what have you, attack them for. That's why you see so many people running for school board races that are normally somewhat sleepy affairs around the country. And I would encourage all your listeners, if you want to make a difference in your community, make a difference for our kids' future, look at what's happening in your school districts. If you don't like it, run for school board. In terms of the amount of time and energy and money invested in a political campaign versus the impact you can have, there may be no bigger payoff in American politics than being on your local school board.
Now, Senator, I think there are two camps, those that want education to be objective and merit-based and those who want something else. And so there's critical race theory, there's Marxism, there's critical gender theory, there's critical legal theory, there's all sorts of non-objective theories, and then there's everybody else. And I think the former, for example, I have CNN up on my screen, Race Deconstructed, sign up to learn about race in America and the role it plays in culture, politics, and more. Well, I'm not signing up for that newsletter, and I don't want that to be in the school. I want the schools to be about academic excellence and to be blind to issues of race and gender. I think that's a majoritarian position. In fact, I think it's a super majoritarian position. Do you agree?
Yeah, I have no question about that, Hugh, that the vast majority of Americans of all races want to live up to the promise of colorblindness in our society. What Dr. Martin Luther King said in his dream speech, that we should be judged by the content of our character, not by the color of our skin, a speech in which he repeatedly and explicitly invoked the Declaration of Independence and our founding principles. He viewed his work in the civil rights movement not as a repudiation of America, but as a full realization of its promise. That's contrary to all these radical leftists today who want to teach our kids to hate America. We want to teach them that it's founded not on freedom, but in bondage. That is not what the vast majority of Americans want. And if you look at schools too, you've got schools that are intentionally harming high-performing students. Again, look up in Northern Virginia. You've got schools like Thomas Jefferson, which I think is in Fairfax, not Loudoun. I'm not sure.
It's yes.
One of the most selective, prestigious public high schools in America. I think they've started to drop AP classes or advanced math or even the test to get into it. Let's just be blunt and call a spade because they think they have too many Asian kids at school. They are going to objectively harm the prospects of hardworking, high-achieving Asian kids because they don't like the racial balance in their schools. Nothing could be more un-American.
Now, I got a direct message from a retired Navy captain earlier today. Good for covering PC3. A free people cannot survive the persistent attempt to teach its youth that their nation is vile. That's succinct. I also believe it's true. Do you?
Of course, Hugh. I mean, Ronald Reagan used to say that we are only one generation away from the extinction of freedom. It is not like the color of your eyes. You don't pass it down as a heritable trait. A society has customs and traditions and habits and a culture, but those things can deteriorate very rapidly if you teach an entire generation of children to despise them, that they are corrupt, that they are irredeemable. That's one reason why it's so important that we protect our schools and the curriculum that our kids see. It's another reason why I fought back so hard against these kind of critical race training sessions in the military. Who's going to raise their hand and take an oath to fight and perhaps die for our Constitution if they think that Constitution is inherently racist, fundamentally flawed and irredeemable?
It becomes very problematic in any setting where allegiance is based on oath. There is a new book coming out by Joseph Ellis, The Cause. I spent 2 hours with him yesterday on the 5th of July holiday programming, talking about the revolutionary cause and what animated it. It was not race-driven. It was liberty-driven. And I believe liberty is actually race, gender, and class-free, Senator Cotton, and that's where we ought to rally around. It really is simply history, not anybody's history, simply history.
That's right, Hugh. You know, I heard your interviews with Mr. Ellis, and I very much enjoyed them. I look forward to that book. If you go back and read some of the great speeches of Abraham Lincoln, especially the speeches he gave in the 1850s about the Kansas-Nebraska Act, which opened the territories to slavery, the noxious Dred Scott decision, which made the false and baseless claim that this country was founded on behalf of the white man, and his debates with Stephen Douglas, even his 4th of July impromptu speeches in 1858 when he responded to Douglas a few days after 4th of July, making explicitly clear that this country was not founded based on any particular race, that the promise of the Declaration of Independence, what he called the electric cord that connects us all, that makes us blood of the blood and flesh of the flesh with those that came before us, is the basis of this nation.
That is the Cooper's Union speech redone for 1858. And I think everyone really needs to know that, Senator. And I think it ought to be part of the curriculum in the United States. It's objectively true. It happened. Stephen Douglas objectively did not want Dred Scott overturned. There are objective positions and objective evils and objective everything. But right now, a tidal wave of PCC is over on gender, on race, on class, on everything is overwhelming the schools. And I think it's not, as Steve Kornack and I were talking about, it's not provoked by Republicans. Parents are reacting to its provocation by the left. That's my belief.
Now, over the last 20 years, the left in America has moved much further to the left. That's, I think, just an objective fact as well. If you look at public opinion polling, the left has launched a culture war against so many normal Americans. It's not the right that is aggravating those issues. We're simply defending people who believe that America is a noble country from the war that the left has been waging. Look, you can pick up any contemporary history book from an author worth his stripes. Say Wilfred Maclay's Land of Hope. Excellent survey of American history. It goes on at great length about the history of slavery in America, for instance, why the Civil War was fought, or what happened in some of the tragedies involving American Indians under the, say, Jackson presidency. It doesn't sugarcoat any of those things. It teaches the history of what actually happened, but it also doesn't condemn America for being a fundamentally flawed and irredeemable land, but rather, as the title says, a land of hope that is consistently fulfilling our founding promise.
That is the way to go. Senator Cotton, thank you for joining me. I think you take that one on the road. Very, very much you can take that on the road. Thank you, Senator. Follow him on Twitter at SendTomCotton, S-E-N Tom Cotton, and you will get more of that. And I expect the same answer from everyone who may run in 2024 that Senator Cotton gave. He has not yet made up his mind. Don't go anywhere, America.